And welcome to Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. This is episode 14. We venture back to MGM with Lost in a Harem. I'm Jerry Shario, and I would like to introduce to you a man who, when asked to describe himself in one word, responded with, "Very bad at following directions." Nick Santamaria.
You know, that's actually true. That's actually true. I am very bad at following directions, as any director will tell you. And I'm a Sicilian, and Sicilians don't like to follow rules as a rule.
Yeah.
I just negated that. Okay.
I have two uncles that are Sicilian, and I understand completely.
Yes. Oh, my God. There's nothing like stubborn bookends. Jerry, how are you?
I'm doing well, sir. Doing well. Slightly disappointed in that I think we mentioned last episode that I was going to an audition soon for Christmas Carol.
Yes.
Didn't get it.
But
I have to say, you know, it's a community theater, first of all, but I know the people and I've worked with them before. But it's always encouraging to me to see a brand new name on a cast list. Uh-huh. And the guy that they cast, I'm not familiar with him at all. I think he's new to the community. So more power to him.
Oh, great. Well, you can go see him. Yep. You know? Yeah. Yep. And see him. And you could look at it and do what I always do when I didn't get a part and I was invited to come see the show. Mm-hmm. I just hated him before the show started. I just hated the person immediately. you know, because it saves time, you know,
oh, yeah.
and effort.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, there's such hatred of the theater. So anyway, we are here. We have gone through hurricanes and
yes.
loss of electricity for about 3 days. You learn how important that electricity is. Mm-hmm. I had to watch TV by candlelight. You know, that's
oh my goodness,
how bad it was.
That's rough.
You know, that really is rough. And
wow.
I want to thank the minstrel people who came up with that joke over 100 years ago. that's such an oldie. But anyway, speaking of oldies, we are looking at a movie made actually 80 years ago.
Wow.
In 1944, 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. And some of the jokes are even older than that in this film. Okay, let's catch up here. But mustard goes with the hot. No, I don't mean ketchup. I mean, let's catch up here. God, I'm doing your straight lines, Jerry. and I'm snorting them right up. No. So anyway, we're looking at Lost in a Harem. And I
yes.
think the key word here is lost. It's certainly not harem. But anyway, Abbott and Costello had just come off a year break. Lou has just come off the biggest tragedy of his life, of anyone's, any parent's life. And he threw himself into work. This is how Lou took care of it. One of his neighbors was Sam Katzman, the B-level producer who mostly released through Monogram Studios. And he was in charge of the East Side Kids and the Bela Lugosi movies and all that stuff. I love him, by the way. So he was a neighbor and a friend of Lou's, and they got together, and I'm sure based on wanting to help Lou out during a very difficult time, he said, would you like to direct the next East Side Kids movie, Blockbusters? Harry Langdon, by the way, has a very tiny role in that. But anyway, Lou accepted. They made announcements to the newspapers and everything, and then Universal stepped in and said, no. So, no, they put the brakes on. And so Lou instead went ahead and formed a company called Biltmore Productions. And his father, Sebastian Cristillo, was listed as the main producer. And Eddie Sherman, their manager, also was involved. And they only made one movie, but it kept Lou busy. He was the producer yeah. of this film. It was called A Wave, A Whack, and A Marine. and interestingly, if you go back to our very first podcast, you remember the story where Henny Youngman gets a screen test and he has to leave the Kate Smith show, and he recommends Abbott and Costello. And this was Lou's way of paying Henny Youngman back. He gave him the major comedy role in this film. It's released by Monogram and it got decent reviews. And Henny Youngman was doing jokes that Abbott and Costello were doing in Society, their next Universal film. So these are all burlesque chestnuts, and I still can't find a copy of this film. And if anyone knows how I can get a hold of it, I would love to see it. So anyway, so Lou threw himself into that. And the first, actually very first film they did once Lou was back was that Mail Call, Who's On First, that they did, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, Lou's kind of puffy and, you know, whatever, but he's back and you know, he's working with Bud and they're going full cylinders. And that's the one where he says, and I don't give a damn rather than, and I don't give a darn, because it was only going to servicemen. That was a radio show called Mail Call. And supposedly soldiers would write in and request, you know, different things. I remember one Bob Hope clip where, they requested Lana Turner frying a steak, and they actually did. They actually did. And Bob Hope says, if you hear sizzling, that's me. That's not the steak. It's he's standing there, Lana Turner. But anyway, so that was Mail Call, and that was their, you know, in a way, their return. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great version of Who's On First, by the way. It's quick.
It really is.
Funny. Yeah.
And I think it's because they've got the live audience. You know, they're working off the crowd there.
Yeah.
And anytime you get up in front of soldiers, you know, they are an appreciative audience.
Yeah, ask Bob Hope, I'll tell you. Bob Hope would walk in front of movie ushers in their uniforms and he'd do 10 minutes. But anyway, so Lou is doing all these things, all these different things. And we talked about this last week, but MGM was next on their film roster. Mm-hmm. And they actually shot Lost in a Harem. But as we said last week, Universal was very set on being the first company to have Lou back or the boys back after a year. And they actually asked MGM to hold up the release of Lost in a Harem. They said they would hold it till September. And that's why the final chase in Society is based around a chase that was already filmed with W.C. Yeah. Fields and Never Give a Sucker. So it just saved them time. They had to do this quickly. And they did. And thank goodness MGM was decent enough to wait. Mm-hmm. And so we're seeing Lou for the first time after the tragedy on camera. Now, I have to say, this is not my favorite Abbott and Costello movie by a long shot. Mm-hmm. No offense to the people that like it, but to me, it's a real slog. By the second half, I'm saying, I want to do something else. I want to watch something else. This is not holding me. No. And which is weird for an Abbott and Costello movie. You know, they're usually like, bam, 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 you know?
Yeah. And for me, one of the things that highlights how slow this movie really is the fact that it's bookended by In Society and another of my all-time favorites, Here Come the Coeds.
Right.
Oh, because they're both excellent films. But this one, you're looking at your watch.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's tough. It really is tough. Jerry and I were talking about this before we started. We don't want to be a drag about this.
No.
But really, I don't think it's a good movie. I don't think it's a good Abbott and Costello movie. Universal, again, made these movies much, much better. You know, the Arabian Nights movies they made with Maria Montez and John Hall and even Shemp and Billy Gilbert. But this is just, it's a slog. You know, for years, I've heard that they saved money. MGM saved money by using the sets left over from the movie Kismet, a big color A movie, you know, from MGM, Ronald Colman and Marlena Dietrich. But Matthew Conium, my co-author on the annotated Abbott and Costello, tells us that this movie was in planning stages and began shooting before Kismet. So actually, Kismet is using Lost in a Harem's settings. So I think that's true. I mean, Matthew did the work. He did the research. Yep. And I really do think that's true, which is kind of fun in a way when you think about it. But they are back at MGM. I will tell you a little bit about the deal. Their first movie for MGM, Rio Rita, made a lot of money. It made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And Abbott and Costello basically got $70,000. Now, that's about three times less than they were making at Universal. for each of their films. And they hated this deal. They just absolutely hated it. So they went to Eddie Sherman and they said, we don't want to do this anymore. This is ridiculous. We're losing money, actually. Yeah. Eddie Sherman said, leave it to me. And he went in and came out with almost $500,000. For the boys.
Wow.
Yeah. For the three movies, actually. And MGM came through. That's how important at this stage, that's how much clout Abbott and Costello had at this stage in their lives. Yeah. MGM did not want to cause any trouble. They wanted this cash cow, you know, mm-hmm. even on a limited basis. That's what they wanted. So anyway, let's talk about the people involved here. We have a new writer, a new Abbott and Costello writer. His name's Harry Ruskin. Now, Harry Ruskin is mostly at MGM writing Dr. Kildare movies, Andy Hardy movies, but he did have a history of movies. He wrote on King of Jazz from 1930, Universal, the Paul Whiteman musical. Mm-hmm. He wrote one of my favorite Paramount W.C. Fields movies, Six of a Kind, which is absolutely hilarious. If you haven't seen it or you haven't seen it in a while, get ready to laugh till you cry. It's that funny. Let's see. He also wrote on the original version of The Glass Key with George Raft. He wrote one of my favorite MGM musical comedies and the last movie Burns and Allen made together, Honolulu. Yes. And he also, get this, wrote on The Postman Always Rings Twice. So he had a pedigree, you know, but boy, he wrote a bad Abbott and Costello movie. and also not to spread gossip or anything, but Cora Sue Collins, the child actress from back then, when she was 15, she had an interview with Mr. Ruskin, who immediately tried to rape her, seduce her. How do I put this? She got away and went to L.B. Mayer, who acted immediately with indifference. So anyway, that's Hollywood in the 40s. Mm-hmm. So that's Harry Ruskin, born in 1894, died 1969 at the age of 74. All right. The other writer, other than John Grant, our pal John Grant, fellow by the name of Harry Crane. Now, comedy fans love Harry Crane. I love Harry Crane. Harry Crane was a writer born in 1914. Lived till 1999. He was 85. He is one of the creators of The Honeymooners. Mm-hmm. When Gleason was hosting a Cavalcade of Stars for the Dumont Network, Harry Crane was helping to write the honeymoon sketches that became the eventual series and actually a career for Jackie Gleason. So Harry Crane had that. He also wrote for Laurel and Hardy in one of their worst films, Air Raid Wardens. He wrote for Fanny Bryce in the Ziegfeld Follies at MGM, which is a hilarious scene. It's an hilarious scene. Mm-hmm. If you want to look that up on YouTube, I believe it's separate. Fanny Bryce, Ziegfeld Follies. And he wrote on the final Thin Man movie, Song of the Thin Man, which isn't as bad as people say. Again, give it a shot. It's really good and it's got some great jazz music and not a bad plot either. I'm sure I'll hear from Scott Ratner about that. So what else? Now, here's the most important thing about Harry Crane.
Yes.
Harry Crane got with Dean Martin after Dean Martin split up with Jerry Lewis and came up with the whole drunk thing. Came up with Dean Martin's personality. He wrote the first act. Yeah. And it was all based on old Joe E. Lewis jokes, you know. Dean borrowed liberally from that whole thing. And Dean became the new drunk guy. And thanks to Harry Crane. And you know what else Harry Crane came up with?
What's that? For
better or worse? Turning the Dean Martin show into the roasts, into the celebrity roasts. Which improved his ratings for another 5 years, I think it was, or four or 5 years. So Harry Crane was very important. He was also the grandfather of Melissa Gilbert and Sarah Gilbert. So yeah, that's interesting, huh? That's
good stuff. Very.
Harry Crane. Okay, so who else is involved? They have a first-time director here. And this is what confuses me about this. Chuck Reisner. Mm-hmm. What a pedigree. I mean, born in 1887, passed away in 1962 at the age of 75, but he started out at Keystone as an actor. He worked with Chaplin as an assistant director. and an actor in A Dog's Life and The Kid. He's the bully in The Kid, and he's all padded up, too. It's very funny. And he co-directed Steamboat Bill Jr. with Buster Keaton, one of Buster's best, I think.
Yeah.
And if you go down the line, you're going to know this about me. When it comes to the Marx Brothers and MGM, I have two favorites. One is A Night at the Opera, which I think is just brilliant, and four shiny stars. That's my rating. There are not four shiny stars in the movie.
yeah, they were only three by that time. So
there were three shiny stars, yes.
Yeah.
They actually hired someone to shine them before they went to MGM. MGM was so glossy, you know, how glossy it is. But anyway, Chuck Reisner directed my other favorite, The Big Store.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just letting people let that sink in. I actually enjoyed The Big Store. I think it's a lot of fun. I call it their Abbott and Costello movie, you know? It was made in the 40s, and it moves, and it's got a great chase at the end. It's an Abbott and Costello movie with the Marx Brothers.
Yes, very much so. I had never thought of it that way, but that is true, yeah.
It's true. And it's easier to watch that way, too, when you consider it. You know, some people watch it, and they think, oh, this isn't like Duck Soup. You know, no, it's not. It's like an Abbott and Costello movie. So Chuck Reisner had quite a pedigree. And he directed this. Okay, let's discuss this, Jerry. Let's talk about why we think this is a weaker vehicle. You want to start?
Well, for me, it's a lot of it is the length. There's a lot of padding. You know, we again, you know, prior to,
and that's just Marilyn Maxwell. No, I'm kidding.
Ba-dum-bum. prior to our recording here today, Nick and I were chatting a bit about this, and you know, the comedy scenes. For the most part, are good. They're top drawer. But even a few of those go just a little too long.
I agree.
And of course, being MGM, there's these huge production numbers that just make you sit there and go, are they done yet?
You smell burning rubber from the screech of the brakes, you know, every time one of these song numbers or dance numbers comes up.
Yes. I made the comparison earlier that, you know, this is Abbott and Costello's A Day at the Races.
I think that's the perfect way to put it. You know, a lot of people like A Day at the Races. I mean, you know, they consider it alongside A Night at the Opera. It's a snore. Just try getting through it. It's just a bore. There are some really good comedy scenes, but not enough to justify sitting through that movie.
Yeah.
And this is like that. You're absolutely right. Yeah. That's a very good analogy. I find that the magic scene, their magic act at the beginning is classic. It's classic Abbott and Costello. In fact, they should just make that a short, you know, and release it that way. I like when Costello is trying to sleep with all the guys around him in the tent, and he can't. Well, we'll get to that, but that really is a classic Lou scene. And there's a couple of very classic burlesque sketches that and Jerry is absolutely right, that go on a little too long, and a couple of them are my favorites, you know. So anyway, so Chuck Reisner is their director. Apparently, according to leading man John Conti, Chuck Reisner was a dream of a director because he wouldn't give you any direction. He'd say, okay, you guys are standing in the right spots. Okay, roll them. And that would be that. So they were perfect kind of director for Abbott and Costello, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And John Conti liked it too. By the way, I also wanted to mention that Chuck Reisner also directed, this is part of his pedigree. This is what I can't believe. The Better Owl with Sidney Chaplin. A feature-length film by Warner Brothers, and it's actually really good. And Sidney Chaplin was really good.
Yeah.
And he was the first guy in the family to become a comedian. And you can see it. He's terrific. On the other end of the spectrum, he also directed in 1931 Flying High, Burt Lahr's first film, based on the Broadway show Flying High. It's so-so. The worst is this one, 1933's The Chief, starring Ed Wynn. Now, I love Ed Wynn. Ed Wynn is one of my favorite comedians, but this is one of the worst movies ever made. so I guess Chuck Reisner is not infallible. He also made a very mediocre movie called It's in the Air in 1935 with Jack Benny and Ted Healy teamed.
Wow.
Yeah. You would expect like some good stuff to come from there.
Yeah.
No, It's MGM. All of those I just mentioned, other than Sidney Chaplin's, were MGM. And then he made Lost in a Harem, which was like, I think he only had a couple more movies to make before he retired. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we're talking about Lost in a Harem. I like the opening titles, and I like the song. The Sons of the Desert.
We don't break the laws, we slightly bend them. We're the hard-headed,
hard-hearted,
quick-witted,
sure-footed sons of the desert. Tired of jokes we will sever, bonds of friendship never, and come the day we swear. If they speak of our guns, if they count upon the sons of the desert, we'll be there.
That one.
Yeah.
Matthew Conium says that the song was put there just to annoy Laurel and Hardy fans. The funny thing is, the song itself, which is really one of the fun songs in the movie,
yes,
done by all the guys on the camels in the desert and all that stuff, it's a lot of fun, but it's only 45 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if all the songs were just... I think we'd have a much better time.
Agreed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. So those opening titles are great with the photos of Bud and Lou all through it. It's just really, really nice job. And John Conti opens our movie. We're in a place called Port Inferno, which doesn't exist. And MGM was adhering to some pleas from Arab nations saying, please don't make fun of us. You know, don't mention Allah or anything like that. That was all part of it. But John Conti shows up as Prince Ramo, and it may be the biggest turban I've ever seen. He's about 5'9", and the turban is 9 inches of that. So he could be 5 foot tall for all I know.
Yep.
It is a huge turban. You could put Deanna Durbin in that turban, but only after drinking bourbon. Okay. I'm writing a song. Hold on. That's a good song. Might show up later. So John Conti, born in 1915, died in 2006 at the age of 90. Interesting career. He was born to Italian and French people. They moved to L.A. when he was 5. He eventually became a member of the Pasadena Playhouse, which was very, very upscale as far as theaters in Los Angeles. He did lots of radio. He did Broadway for Rodgers and Hammerstein, one of their more mediocre shows, Allegro, in 1947. He was also in Carousel in 1954. He did a lot of early TV. He had his own show from 1950 to 1953, the John Conti Show. He hosted obscure game shows for Max Liebman, the producer of Your Show of Shows, Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca. He did two musical spectaculars, starred in them, Desert Song and Naughty Marietta, two famous operettas. He hosted matinee theater starting at 12 noon from 1955 to 1959. Then eventually he and his then wife bought a television station. They bought KMIR TV, an NBC affiliate for Palm Springs, Rancho Mirage, very rich area, and they made it into a complete success. So what a life, what a career. And you know, you look at him in this movie and you think, he's not very good. But my goodness, he had quite a life. Huh?
Well, that's just it. You know, you watch him in this movie and you think he's got to be good at something. And apparently he was.
Kind of like the Zeppo thing, you know?
Yes.
I'm reading the new Zeppo book, and it's like, you know, you look at him in the movies and you think, no one could be more ineffectual, you know, unless they were completely invisible. No one could be more ineffectual than Zeppo Marx. Yet, in real life, he was the most vibrant. He was the richest. Mm-hmm. He was the most diverse, you know? So you never know just by looking at these people. He also made a couple of other movies, small roles in a couple of other movies. The Man with the Golden Arm, an excellent Frank Sinatra film by Otto Preminger. And The Carpetbaggers, which was Alan Ladd's last movie, actually. Okay, so Prince Ramo, he's obsessed with Marilyn Maxwell, who plays Hazel
Moon.
Bishop? No.
Moon.
Hazel Moon.
Yes.
Unless she's sitting down, then she's Hazel Half Moon.
Exactly.
But, yes. But anyway, she's blonde, and she is the only blonde within like 1,000 miles radius. Anyway, so Prince Ramo, John Conti, is obsessed with her and keeps going back to the Café International to see her and hear her sing. Okay, so he goes in. He meets Ralph Sanford, the owner, who's for some reason is wearing this obnoxious fake nose.
Yes!
It's like MGM. You know what? Let's give him a fake nose, and then maybe we'll be good at comedy.
You keep waiting for a payoff or for an explanation or something, and it never comes.
Oh, it's terrible. It's just terrible. I don't understand it at all. And never did. Even when I was a kid, it was like, why did they do that? So anyway, so Ralph Sanford and his nose bring Prince Ramo to his seat, and we meet Marilyn Maxwell, who is quite a dish. Was that politically correct? I hope not. So she does a song, and it's actually a good song. I actually like this song. What Does It Take to Get You? It's called.
I can get a diamond solitaire. That's easy as pie. If I want to travel, I can get the fare. Cause I know a guy. I can get a mink with just a wink. Or even less. And I can dig gold, but big, and I dig it with finesse.
And what's interesting about this song, or mostly interesting about this song, is that Marilyn Maxwell had a reputation in Hollywood. Let's talk about Marilyn. Her real name is Marvel Marilyn Maxwell. Marvel, or it could be Marvel, I don't know. But yeah. It's spelled Marvel. Born in 1921. Passed away young at the age of 50. She had a massive heart attack in 1972. But anyway, she was a singer with the Ted Weems band. Ted Weems, mostly famous for introducing Perry Como to audiences. And she also got involved with the Pasadena Playhouse. It was seen by MGM scouts and was signed to a contract at MGM. In the meantime, she's having a kick-ass affair with Frank Sinatra. Mm-hmm. Lasts a few years. Well, first of all, I was going to say that in this song, she says,
I can get a penthouse any place, complete with a view. I can even get as far as second base with Frank Sinatra, too. And I can bet.
And I'm thinking, whoa. A few eyebrows went up there, I'll imagine, and, you know, at the preview, you know, as they're sitting there watching it. Anyway, I'm sure Nancy Sinatra had a great time. But anyway, so the big thing about Marilyn Maxwell was her affair with Bob Hope. It was a well-known secret in Hollywood that they were keeping company. Even Dolores, his wife, knew about it. In fact, Marilyn Maxwell was known as the second Mrs. Bob Hope. And she did a couple of movies with him, The Lemon Drop Kid, and did Silver Bells with him.
Yes.
Which was a great scene. Really terrific. And mm-hmm. she's terrific. I think she's great.
She is. She is.
And she's also in one of my least favorite Bob Hope movies, Off Limits, with Mickey Rooney and Bob Hope. And she's in Rockabye Baby with Jerry Lewis, one of the least offensive Jerry Lewis movies for me. I just read a new book about Jerry Lewis, and oh boy, I was right about everything, folks. I was right about everything. I don't want to hear anything else about him. I was right. He's just, ugh. Anyway, we'll get into that in another episode. So yeah, so here we have Marilyn Maxwell, and she comes out, she does this song. Ralph Sanford and his nose ask her to sit with Prince Ramo, but she doesn't want to. But she says, I will do it if you don't fire my two friends, Pete Johnson and Harvey Garvey. Now, you can imagine who Harvey Garvey is. Pete Johnson is. It's our two friends, Bud and Lou. Now, they get to do their act, which is a magic act. Mm-hmm. Now, Bud makes his appearance behind the curtains. He throws open the curtains and makes a grand entrance. And of course, Lou is next. He throws open the curtains and does an amazing fall as all the curtains come down on him. It's a moment I love. It really is a moment I love.
Oh, yeah.
So then they go into what I consider to be probably the funniest part of the movie. And it's right mm-hmm. at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's their magic act where Lou and Bud Well, Bud is the magician. Lou is sort of his assistant, I guess. And Bud has these silver tubes that Lou knows are really tin. But every time he says tin, Bud slaps him.
Now, here we have just an ordinary little silver cup.
That's silver?
Nothing? Yeah, silver.
That's silver.
There's nothing in it. Absolutely, it's silver.
Certainly. That's tin.
Don't say tin. You know that's silver.
Oh, eh?
I say it's silver.
Oh, we're lying to the shit.
Quiet. That's silver, Fred.
That's tin.
I say it's silver.
That's funny looking silver.
That's what it is. That's what I bought and paid for, is silver.
Well, you got tin.
Don't say tin.
I know you got this.
Never mind. When I say silver, I mean silver.
And when I say... Mm-hmm,
don't say mm-hmm. it. Just don't say it.
I ain't gonna say it.
Say what?
That word.
What word?
The word you want me to say.
What is that?
I ain't gonna say it.
Well, don't say it.
You think I'm gonna say it?
Ha ha! Ha ha ha! All right, never mind that.
You thought I was gonna say tin.
Don't say tin.
I said it, so what?
Well, keep quiet.
All right.
Now, we'll place the little...
Silver?
Silver cover. What's the matter? Oh, pardon me. I see. Yes, all right. Indigestion. Yeah. Now we place a little silver cover.
So it's very funny, back and forth. Bud makes the bottle and the cup go from table to table, you know, bouncing back and forth underneath the tin or silver tubes. So I don't know if I'm describing it well, but it is just so funny. And the funniest part for me, Jerry, I don't know if you agree with me, but is when Lou says...
Can you make the bottle go from here back over there and the glass from over there back over there?
You mean to transfer the glass from over there over to there and the little bottle from over there over to there?
Yeah, make a little...
All right, please.
Why,
it's very simple.
It's so, you know, they made that up on the spot one night and said, we're keeping it. We're keeping it in. Oh, it's so funny. And Bud gets to be just as funny as Lou in that moment. So anyway, they do their magic act. And of course, Lou screws everything up. And they cause this enormous fight. And oh, by the way, our friend Harry Wilson is in one shot in the audience. Mr. Ugly, Harry Wilson,
who
we talk about quite a bit all the time. We like him. He's great. He's like the ugliest man in Hollywood.
He's kind of hard to miss. So, yeah, that's why we talk about him.
Yeah, he's something. He's very interesting. But I only saw him in one shot, and that was as part of the audience. And, oh, I also missed when Marilyn Maxwell is singing her song. She goes into the audience and she starts, you know, flirting with the guy sitting in the crowd. The very first person that she flirts with, you think, is Hugh Herbert. You know, Hugh Herbert, the comedian.
Wonderful.
Ooh, him. But it's his brother, Tom, his lookalike brother, Tom Herbert, who would sometimes double for his brother. There's a story. I went to CineCon one year and they showed a movie called Six Lessons from Madame Lazanga, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And Hugh Herbert, I remember reading this in a book by Leonard Maltin. He says Hugh Herbert really deserved like an Oscar because he plays six different characters in one scene, you know, almost like Eddie Murphy in Nutty Professor, you know.
Yeah.
And he goes, it's amazing. He's a woman in one thing and he's an old man in the other thing. Blah, blah, blah. So I'm watching the movie and I'm thinking, no, And I had to do a presentation right after the movie. And I got up and I said, I know everybody thinks that Hugh Herbert did six roles at that thing, but it was his brother, Tom, playing like three of those roles. So anyway, even Maltin didn't know that. So my friend Ray Fayola is the only other person in that entire theater that caught it. So we meet him at the very top. So if you want to go back, folks, and look at your Lost in a Harem, you'll see Tom Herbert. And he's doing all this Hugh Herbert stuff. Anyway, so Bud and Lou start a big fight, and they're taken away to jail. Now, this could have taken another avenue at this point. It could have been like Midnight Express, you know? I hate these Turkish prisons.
What did I tell you? Where did you put the heroin?
So
you don't She's in know. The cell next to us.
Marilyn Maxwell.
Yes.
And she does Maxwell, I would say. So, okay. So we know about John Conti. We know about Marilyn Maxwell. What we don't know is they became engaged during the shooting of this film. And they got married eventually. It only lasted 2 years, but they got married. I suppose it was Marilyn's extracurricular activities. Not to spread any rumors. So I was talking about Marilyn Maxwell. Another interesting thing about her was that she was occasionally a beard for Rock Hudson. She would go on dates with Rock Hudson and make him look less homosexual. Mm-hmm. And her pallbearers at her funeral, Hope, Crosby, Sinatra, and Jack Benny.
Wow.
That's quite a star-studded coffin, you know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, was this the first time that she had worked with Bud and Lou?
No, she was part of their radio show.
So that did come first. Okay.
Yeah, I believe it did. I can't be sure. I'm not completely sure on that, but I'm assuming. Well, first of all, she was already under contract to MGM, and she was associated with their radio show. So I assume maybe that was a reason why, you know, maybe she was cast in this film. Who knows? Okay. We're also forgetting Jimmy Dorsey.
Oh, yeah. Now,
Jimmy Dorsey and his band are in this movie, and Jimmy shows that sterling, sparkling personality that he always had. He was often mistaken for a speed bump. that's how much personality this man had. I will say this, both Dorsey brothers, Tommy and Jimmy, were both under contract to MGM, and which is kind of quite something. They didn't talk. They did not get along. Tommy and Jimmy. But apparently Jimmy was the better musician. That's what I hear from musician friends and reading about it. Yeah, Jimmy was a virtuoso on the reeds, you know, clarinet and saxophone.
Well, yeah.
And if you hear his solos, they're just incredible.
In fact, the big number that his orchestra does in this, it first caught me off guard when, you know, he's playing the clarinet and then all of a sudden it turns into a saxophone and then it turns back into a clarinet and he plays them all beautifully. Mm-hmm. But also the direction of that musical number made it interesting to watch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Unlike all the other musical numbers.
No, as I was watching it, I was thinking to myself, it plays like a music video for one thing.
Yes.
The camera work is just amazing.
Yeah.
And it would, if they cut it out of the film and released it as a short, it would work, you know, just on its own. But it stops the movie dead. My only qualm about it is it's beautiful. It's filmed beautifully. The music is great. It stops the movie dead. And this movie cannot afford to be stopped dead, you know. So, okay, they're in jail. Marilyn gets her own cell. And Bud and Lou end up in a cell with burlesque straight man and comedian Murray Leonard. Now, I said last week that their burlesque friends would visit them occasionally, even stay with them. And Bud and Lou would go to the studio and say, by the way, Murray Leonard's in town. And you know what he does better than anyone else? Slowly I Turned, you know, the Niagara Falls bit. Mm-hmm. And that's what they did. And they got Murray working at MGM for this film. And he is the running gag all the way through. He even gets the final gag. And then he shows up in Society as well. And a few others, and their TV show as well. So they took care of Murray, and he paid them by being brilliant. He's a brilliant performer. So they do Slowly I Turn. Slowly I Turn. Only now it was the banks of the Pocomoco.
Yep.
So every time he hears Pocomoco, he beats up Lou.
Every time he hears that word, Pocomoco.
Pocomoco! Oh, I knew I'd never be satisfied until I had his blood running between my fingers. So slowly I turned. Step by step. Step by step I crept upon him. And when I saw the smirk on his countenance, I threw it. And then the rest of me, I hit it from all angles. I couldn't help myself. I was going out of my mind.
Stand still. What's the matter with you? The man's telling you his life's history. Most interesting.
My poor friend. I did it again, did I?
Oh, it's all right.
What's happening to me?
There's nothing happening to you, brother. It's all happening over here. Oh, I will just don't use that word.
Don't say it.
He means Pocahontas.
Pocahontas.
That's all right. Sounds like Kokomo or
something. Pocomoco! Oh, I did it again. so slowly.
And that's the way this goes. Unfortunately, it just goes on a little too long.
Yes.
And I have to say that the version with Sid Fields in their film television show is really, it's superior. And Sid Fields, no one beats up Lou like Sid Fields. And I think, you know, I think people listening that know about, you know, their TV show are nodding in agreement.
Oh,
right,
yeah.
Now. He just brutalizes him. He just, you know, it's sometimes hard to watch. But when you know that version, this one's a little milder by comparison. But this is what I love about this scene. Him, his presentation, his telling the story. Mm-hmm. It's just beautiful. He's very articulate. He's very theatrical. He's got a very fine, rich voice, you know, and he hits those consonants. I think he's terrific. I really do. So they get out of prison. They escape. And this is a funny gag. Bud and Marilyn run out and Lou is left behind. And what happens is there are about five guards about to ascend on him or descend on him. Whatchamacallit, he yells Pocomoco. And of course, Murray Leonard picks up a hammer and just starts hitting all the guards, and they're all unconscious. And Lou has something on his head. He can't see. His hat, I think, is over his mm-hmm. eyes. And he accidentally hits the wall with his fist. So when he takes off the thing and he can see, his fist is hurting him, and he sees five guys all unconscious. So he thinks he knocked them all out. And when Bud comes back, the look on his face is like, holy crap. Look at, oh my God. Yeah. Maybe I better stop slapping this guy. and Lou plays it up really well. That was really nice the way he left. Okay. So they're out of prison and they hear Prince Ramos' plan. And here's the deal. His uncle, the evil Douglas Dumbrio, who plays Nivitov. Anyway, it's vitamin spelled backwards.
Yes. Nimitiv. There we go.
Nimitiv.
Yeah.
That would be right. It's vitamin backwards. I have no idea why. But Douglas Dumbrio, the classic movie villain, mm-hmm. Worked with Chuck Reisner before in The Big Store with the Marx Brothers. And he's just one of my all-time favorites. One very quick side note about Douglas Dumbrio that might interest our listeners. Douglas Dumbrio, when he was an old man, when he was in his 70s, he married the daughter, who was in her late 20s, early 30s, of Alan Mowbray, the British actor, one of my favorite character actors of all time. And Alan Mowbray would not speak to them for the rest of his life. He was so angry that Douglas Dumbrio married his daughter. Oh, my God. It's just, you know, just there's a little side note for you. Way to go, Douglas. Way to go. speaking for us old farts, you know, it's mm-hmm. nice to hear once in a while. So here's the deal. Douglas Dumbrio is the uncle, the evil uncle, who has taken over the throne from Prince Ramo. And he loves blondes, and there aren't any. So the reason Prince Ramo kept obsessing about Marilyn Maxwell is he's getting up the nerve to ask her to help him be bait for his uncle so he could steal his uncle's cat's eye rings and use them to hypnotize him, because he hypnotizes everybody around him. And that's really the lame plot.
I don't even know if it'd be worthy calling it a MacGuffin, but you know, that's what it is. Yeah.
That's what it is. More lame than lame. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
So they not reluctantly. They're very, they want to help. Hey, they want to help with the kids. So they're in on it. Thank you, Chica. They're in on it. And so they have to go to the camp where, you know, the encampment where they're getting ready to do their plans. And so they have to sleep. Everybody has to sleep. And there's this big tent. And around the tent pole are about 20 of these, you know, guys, these Arab guys, and they're all laying out, you know, if you could picture petals, you know, like mm-hmm. flower petals around this pole. And Lou is next to, I want to get this name right, Adia Kuznetsov.
Sure.
Gesundheit. No, Adia Kuznetsov. I did it right the first time. Anyway, movie buffs love him because he was in Swiss Miss with Laurel and Hardy. He was their their nemesis in the kitchen.
Yep.
But even more so, if you are a Universal monster kid, Frankenstein meets the Wolfman. He's the one that sings that song. And Lon Chaney gets up, stop it, stop it. You know, follow me, follow law. That one. But we love him. He's just wonderful. And he plays the guy with the really long beard. He's the tough, like, second in command. And he's next to Lou. And next to, on the other side of Adia, is character actor Leon Askin.
Yes.
Who plays, Colonel Burkholder in Hogan's Heroes,
yes,
among many other things. Also shows up with Pope and Crosby and Road to Bally. But he's on the other side. And every time he expels air in one of his snores, it blows Adia's beard onto Lou's face. And it keeps happening. And it's hilarious. I have to tell you, I'm a bad sleeper. And this used to give me nightmares looking at this scene because I could never sleep like they were sleeping. I have claustrophobia. So this scene just hits me. It just makes me laugh. So the beard keeps going into his face. And what they do is they steal the gag from themselves where Lou is trying to milk the cow in Ride 'Em Cowboy. And the cow keeps hitting him in the face with his tail. So he ties a wrench to the tail so to weigh it down, and of course the wrench hits him in the head and knocks him out. Well, in this one he ties
a coin purse,
right? And it's very heavy, shows how heavy it is, and of course it hits him in the head, and you know, whatever. But that's not the end of this scene. There's more. He just can't, he can't cut a break in this. So he decides, you know what, I'll turn my back to him. And he has this enormous sword, Adia. And of course he pokes Lou in the butt, and that wakes everybody up again. Then he tells him, if you wake me up again, I'll kill you. I'll slit your throat. So Lou is like, oh my God, you know. So Lou is in bed. I mean, he lays back down and he realizes his arm is under Adia. He's stuck and he can't move. And a goat comes into the tent and starts licking his feet. I'm sorry, but that is just, I'm guessing John Grant or Harry Crane. So then eventually Lou gets up and he gets, you know how babies sometimes get up and their butts are in the air and their heads are down on the pillow. Well, the goat sees this and runs and butts Lou in the butt. He hits the tent pole and the whole tent comes down, and it's the perfect ending to a perfect scene, I have to say.
Yep.
The magic scene and this scene are two of really some of the best stuff they've ever done in one of the worst movies ever made.
Yep.
I hate to say that, but that. So that goes down, and they have to get into the palace now, and they meet a giant. Now, I don't know how you feel about this, Jerry, but when I watch Jack and the Beanstalk with Abbott and Costello, Buddy Bear is a fine giant. He's vicious, he's cruel, but he's not especially giant. You know what I mean?
He's like, I agree.
He would be the runt of the litter, the giant litter. And if you've ever tried to lift giant litter, you know, I used to be a litter carrier, but I could go on for hours and do often. So anyway, I just thought this guy would have been a better choice for Jack and the Beanstalk because he's a literal giant.
Yes. The only deterrent, in my opinion, would be the fact that he looks like he's, 7'9" and weighs 12 pounds.
You're close. He's 7'7".
Okay.
Very close.
But he's a beanpole,
They could have
menace
with the costume, and even with the big shoes and stuff, he'd be up over 8 foot tall.
That's
a giant, you know?
Yeah.
And they also dubbed his voice. So I'm assuming that he couldn't act either. His name was Lockhart Martin, born Joseph. And he was a twin.
One of the things I find interesting in this is they've cast him physically in the role, but they had to dub his voice, and they dub his voice with perhaps one of the smallest actors in Hollywood at the time, but with a voice, Billy Bletcher.
Billy Bletcher. Our boy, Billy. Whenever I think of Billy Bletcher, I think of an R Gang episode the one where they go to the cave overnight, you know?
Yes.
And they
yes.
have the jelly sandwiches and all. What is that called again? I don't know. I don't remember. But Billy Bletcher plays Spanky's father. And he says to the wife, "They'll be back." And for some reason, that stays in my head. "They'll be back."
Yes, it was almost like the original version of the Goonies. That
yeah,
short, you know?
In a way.
Yeah.
I don't know much about the Marx Brothers, but yeah. but my ex-partner, and I say ex because he's dead. Mm-hmm. I can kill him for dying. Will Ryan, my buddy, my Schuster to my Biffle, part of his living was made imitating the late Billy Bletcher. In fact, he did Billy in that last cartoon, the Road one that was released with Frozen. He did the voice for Billy Bletcher. He also did the giant in Mickey's Christmas Carol, which was Billy Gilbert.
Yep.
And he also did Billy Bletcher as, you know, Black Pete. As
Yes.
Yeah. But anyway, he was an amazing voice artist, my partner, an amazing man. Anyway, they promise this giant with the weird voice that they will get him in the movies. And now I think this whole thing was lame, Jerry. I'm sorry. The whole thing about getting him in the movies and then at the end with Tima, with the little chubby girl, getting her in the movies. Well, oh, yeah, we're talent scouts. And blah, blah, blah. It even plays into the finale, which is one of the worst, probably the worst they've ever done. But anyway, we'll get around to that.
Yeah.
So they get in. The giant lets them in. And I don't know. They have to deal with, what's his name now? With Douglas Dimbrill.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's so funny about this movie. I don't know it as well as I do the other ones. Because where I grew up in New York, we had the Universals and even some of their independents shown on one station every Sunday morning.
Yep.
To see these MGM movies, you'd have to wait maybe once a year on CBS. They would show them like on an afternoon movie on a Sunday or a Saturday. So you didn't see them all that often. And this one, I have to rely on my notes because I'm looking at the order of things and I just don't know them. I don't know them as well. Mm-hmm. So let's see. We have, they get in. I like the name of the place where they are. They're not in Port Inferno anymore. They're in Bar Bihar.
Yes.
Bahia Bar.
Something like that.
Yeah, Bahia Bar. So yeah, they're
Babar
there.
The elephant. Yeah, that's where they are.
Yeah, that's it. And by the way, my penchant for mentioning scenes that were cut in these movies, there is one that in the morning when they wake up after the disastrous sleeping scene, Prince Ramo tells them, you know, we need to meet at the castle and blah, blah, blah. You guys get on the camels. Right. And he leaves. Lou does a version of the hammock scene from In the Navy, where he keeps trying to get into the hammock and he falls over. He does it with the camel. And apparently MGM built this mechanical camel that he worked with. That scene is completely cut. All you hear is now get on the camels and you can blah, blah, blah. So that's that. So that's kind of interesting. Man. And that might have helped the movie a little bit.
And it needed it.
Yeah. You know, before the sleeping scene is the song Sons of the Desert, you know, which is 45 seconds long. And it really is a rousing song. It's actually a better song than We Are the Sons of the Desert. The Sons of Our Life. It's a better song. Anyway, so that's just one of the many numbers. So let's see. I have the goat getting on the camels. That Locke Martin's twin passed away in childbirth. Can you imagine? Two giants inside of this lady. I can't even imagine. She probably walked funny for the rest of her life. And they were born in South Philadelphia, which is strange because they're not Italian. And is Italian. And probably most importantly, do you know what he played, Locke Martin? Played Gort in The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yes!
Yes! He was in the Gort outfit. So he's special. He's a special man. If only for that, you know?
Yeah.
He was also on You Bet Your Life, by the way. He did one appearance on You Bet Your Life in 1951.
Oh.
And he was with Spike Jones and his band for a while on the road and even did a few of his TV shows. Mm. So that's interesting. And on his off time, when he wasn't working in show business, he was a doorman at Grauman's Chinese Theater. How about that?
Wow.
You don't get this information anywhere else, folks. And that speaks well for you.
Yes.
I love the mind reader bit is a classic burlesque.
Oh, that gag. Is a great gag.
So yeah, clever.
And it's done so well.
Beautifully. The camera work at the end for the punchline is
yes.
just great because it mixes in Bud coming into the scene.
Yes.
As you see the sign. So what we're talking about is Lou is standing on the street looking at this beautiful woman from behind. And you could see her face. She feels a little uncomfortable. And she finally turns around. She walks up to Lou and slaps him in the face and walks away. And Lou looks confused. The camera moves away from him. We see Bud entering the scene. And the camera lifts a little bit. And you see mind reader. She was a mind reader. it's a very clever joke. So anyway, that's that. That's before they get into the palace. Now, did you notice one of the Douglas Dumbrill's top aides, a rather hefty looking fella?
I noticed him. Yes, he was hard to miss because he's such a hefty fellow. But that's as far as I can go.
That's Tor Johnson.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Tor Lightblood and Lou. Yeah.
I missed that completely. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I noticed it for the first time, actually, last night as I was watching. Tor Johnson. And it's a pretty, I'm not going to say a major role, but it's a supporting role.
Yeah.
And he's got some lines. He even has some dialogue. Mm-hmm. Tor Johnson is on his side. So he hypnotizes Bud and Lou. Okay. Douglas Dumbrill, let's just cut to the chase. He hypnotizes Bud and Lou, and as he's walking away, he inadvertently calls them termites. So Bud and Lou think they are termites, and they start eating the furniture. I just don't think it's funny.
No.
I just don't think it's
funny. No.
It should be.
No.
But it's not. And they're talking in these mechanical voices like they're robots or whatever. And it's just not funny. So anyway, they go away from there and they do some more plot stuff. And I think there's even this is where the Jimmy Dorsey number comes in.
Yes.
Right. And when we meet the Jimmy Dorsey orchestra earlier on in the movie, they are all hypnotized by Douglas Dumbrill as they're walking at a big parade playing their music, which I think is really silly. But anyway, so Jimmy Dorsey does that number. I recommend watching it because it really is filmed beautifully.
Yeah. Yeah.
You could see where a lot of the money went. This movie was had a budget of $1,200,000.
Wow.
As opposed to, like the $500,000 they usually spend at Universal. So This is MGM. Opulence. I told you about Eddie Sherman renegotiating their contract. Mm-hmm. But anyway, at one point, Lou is pretending to be a laundryman. And he says, I wrote these down. He says, come on, bring us your clothes. You soil it, we boil it. You wear it, we'll tear it. We call Mondays for your undies. Which I thought was kind of cute. and then they hide under the couch. And they do a bunch of gags about Douglas Dumbrill sitting on the couch and the boys hitting their heads on the floor and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. It's very Three Stooges and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it belongs with the Three Stooges. And I don't mean to be condescending about the Three Stooges, but Abbott and Costello weren't the Three Stooges.
No.
And then there's a harem dance that if you need to catch up on your sleep, this might be a good time. Or even just to, maybe visit the bathroom or make a sandwich. It's boring and it goes on seemingly forever. But anyway, they end up in the dungeon again. And this is where they meet Murray Leonard again. Mm-hmm. I think Bud even says, at least we don't have that guy around. And then you hear him,
Yeah.
And they do the second part of this bit. And they do this again with Sid Fields in the TV show. And I think it's better. With Murray Leonard, they do Mike's Place, meaning that he tells them he's going to help them escape. And he only goes around a pillar and says, here we are. we're at Mike's place. And he's completely out of his mind. Mm-hmm. Mike gives them drinks and all this stuff. And Mike isn't there. There's no bar. There's no nothing. Bud buys into it immediately, if only to make Lou feel more uncomfortable. Because that's his job. Yeah, and this goes on seemingly forever. I hate to say it. It's just a little bit more compact, you know, in the TV show later on. And, you know, Murray Leonard, again, he's wonderful. And I liked Lou's pantomime with the piano and all that stuff. But it kind of goes on and doesn't really go anywhere. I hate to say it because really these are three pros, you know, doing classic material. But I don't know if it's just MGM or the way it was shot or I don't know. I really don't know. I do like the line where they call him crazy and Murray Leonard says, I had a brother who was crazy, but I'm all right. And Lou says, who told you? And he goes, my brother. I like that. But there's even a talking skeleton. But these are all audio jokes. These are all watching them do the actions and hearing the audio from somewhere, you know. And it gets old. It gets old. So anyway, Hazel offers herself to Douglas Dimbrell in order to save the others. And Douglas Dimbrell has a very funny joke here. And I'm sorry, it's not even really a joke. It's a timing thing. She says, I offer myself if you let the other ones go. And he says, nonsense, they will never escape. And a guard runs in and says, they escaped. He gets up and goes, what? You know, it's that kind of a thing. And he's great. He's just, Douglas Dimbrell is great. He really is. Yeah. I think in some ways, sometimes when I'm watching him, he might be funnier than the comedians he's torturing, you know, off stage, you know, he just seems that way. He's the one who married the 30-year-old, you know, when he was in his 70s. So, okay. Bud and Lou, at one point, they're hiding in these urns, these huge urns that are broken down. And when Bud goes to get Lou's, he's not in it. I don't know. It's crazy. Bud mentions being assassinated and he goes, no, I was, when I was a baby, I was assassinated on the arm. Didn't hurt. And of course, Bud slaps him. And I'm sure that hurt. But that was a funny moment. I remember I laughed out loud at that.
Yes.
So they decide to dress up. Bud is going to dress up as Douglas Dimbrell. And Lou is going to dress up as Tima, who is the chubby wife of the harem. And Tima looks like Lou in drag. So Lou is going to dress up as Tima, played by Lottie Harrison.
Yeah. Okay.
And we don't know much about her. Yeah.
Well, you know, you got to figure that was probably a very weird casting call. They're looking for a woman who looks like Lou Costello. You know?
And Rosie O'Donnell wasn't born yet. So.
Exactly.
I always thought Rosie O'Donnell looked like Lou Costello. Mm-hmm. So they dress up and Lou dresses up like Tima and Bud gets to do a version of the mirror routine with Douglas Dimbrell and he does a great job. When Bud's given stuff to do, he really comes through. He really does, I have to say. Pardon my sarong when he comes out as the magician with the French accent and everything. It's like you want to yell and say, give him more to do. That's great.
Yeah.
There's a great moment where Lou actually sits on the giant's lap to talk to him. He sits like a baby, you know, sitting there. And he looks like a baby. It's amazing. There's even a point where they're hiding from Douglas Dimbrell and Bud has a, he's under wraps. He's a mother and he's got a papoose in the back, but it's Lou coming up through the bag in the back. So you just see his upper part, you know, and he pretends he's a baby and it works. He looks like a baby.
Yeah.
He's got that baby face. So they're dressed as the other people, blah, blah, blah. Let's just get down to it. One thing I love about when they're getting dressed up, Bud makes a point to say, boy, my experience with makeup is really coming in handy. What? So I guess Bud had another life as, you know, an assistant to Jack Pierce or something. I don't know.
I took that as the writer's way of reminding us way back in the beginning of the movie that these guys are vaudeville performers stranded in this country. So, you know, in case you forgot, you know, we'll go back to that.
And the makeup looks so beautifully placed. by MGM makeup people.
Yes.
You had to explain why Bud made it look so professional, because my makeup experience is just so wonderful. And that reminds me, there is a Kevin Brownlow delivery that I did want to mention before we finish.
We were so close. I
fought myself today. Am I going to torture Jerry today or am I not? Fortunately, I decided to torture you. So,
okay.
This is an interesting clip, actually. And it's during a very interesting time in Bud's life. You remember when he did his own voice for the cartoon series for Hanna-Barbera? Mm-hmm. He did his own thing. And this is interesting. You'll get the gist of it when I play the clip. Hold on. In the office of Bill Hanna and Joe Barbera. Here we go. Hold on. Thank you. Thank you so much for inviting me to do my own voice. This is fantastic. Thank you so much. Certainly it is. Thank you, Bud. Thank you for showing up. We do have a reason for asking you here early, if you don't mind. We haven't decided yet on who is going to do Lou's voice. And we thought that you, being the expert, of course, maybe you can help us decide. It's down to two people, all right? Now, we'll play you tapes. This is the first one. Here we go.
You know, if we take the rocket to the moon, we might be able to meet some Martians.
All right, that's the first one. That's a...
Who was that?
That was George Sanders. His agent sent him over. He needed the work, and we thought we'd try him out as Lou. Here's the second choice. Hold on one second.
Hey, Abbott! If we take the rocket to the moon, we might meet some Martians!
Who the hell was that?
That was, you knew him in Vegas. His name is Stan Irwin.
George Sanders. Go with George Sanders. Definitely George Sanders.
And that's all we have. That's the last one. Unfortunately, they didn't listen to him.
And they should have.
Seriously, Stan Irwin. I hear one of those cartoons and I want a license to hunt him. You know, he's like, oh, he's awful. He's absolutely awful. All right. So, okay, let's get to the bottom of this. Here's the lame ending. Okay. The girls in the harem decide that Bud and Lou are Hollywood talent scouts and Douglas Dimbrill is going to block their way into show business. So what do? The girls attack the guards. Anyway, it's really boring and it's very unimaginative. So anyway, they do get their revenge on Douglas Dimbrill, which is really weird. They get his rings and they hypnotize him into thinking he's a dog. And they tell him to go to the kennels. And he makes this grand exit, doing the whole, you know, as he goes out. But that's kind of funny. But anyway, the ending I like. The ending I think is very funny.
Yes.
In the movie, yes. They keep running into Murray Leonard, right? The crazy guy in the jail. So when they get into their conveyance, their car, and they're in the back seat and there's a driver. And of course, they decide, where are we going? And one of them says, Pocomoco. And it turns out the driver is Murray Leonard. The boys get out and run into the distance for the big fade out. And we're happy about it.
Yeah. If you stop and think about it, that ending also is rather Stooge-like. You know,
it is.
A number of the Stooges films ended with them running off into the distance. Every one of their cartoons ended with them running into the distance.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And usually in the movies you hear woo, 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 as they're running away. We're kind of, you know, you wanted to like grab MGM by the lapels and just slap a little bit and say, hey, you know what? Let the experts take care of this. Yeah. Thank God they went back to Universal and made In Society one of their better films. Mm-hmm. And like you say, you know, Here Come the Coeds is coming up, and that's another one of their really, really good films. Yeah. So that's how I feel. I've always felt that way about Lost in the Harem. I've never taken to it. I always thought the first half was okay. I could get through it. And then by the second half, I lose interest. Yeah. There's too much. It's just,
And I agree with you on the, as far as the availability of this film back in the day, because, you know, I also grew up in Boston, mm-hmm. with Abbott and Costello on TV every Saturday night. But it was, I think it was just the Universals. I don't think we even got the Independents.
Mm-hmm. You didn't get New Sang's High or?
No. So yeah, it was probably, you know, well into my adult years before I first saw any of the MGMs.
Mm-hmm. That goes along with my theory about films we love as adults yeah. are the films we grew up loving. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? The films, I think some people would look at certain films and say, well, that's not a very good movie. It is to me. You know what yeah. I mean? Because I have that memory, whether it's watching with my family or with my parents, you know, a good loving memory.
So. And to this day, I torture my family with the fact that one of those films for me is Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
I can go one better than that. That one is almost too mainstream for me. I have two that I sit through every so often just to prove that I have resilience. And one is Santa and the Ice Cream Bunny.
What?
Which was filmed in Miami. And with no soundtrack, it was all dubbed. And it's about Santa Claus landing his sled on Miami Beach and not knowing how to get off it. And that's all it is. And it's the most surreal experience you'll ever have with a movie, I promise you. And the other one is just called Santa Claus. It's a Mexican movie. And they used to show it all the time in matinees in my neighborhood. And that one's really weird. That's the one where Santa Claus battles the devil, the actual devil.
Wow. That sounds like it would be quite the altercation.
All right. Thank you for joining us. And Jerry, thank you again. Always a pleasure.
And it's been an enjoyable experience again with you, my friend.
And I'm sorry that, we didn't like this movie as much. But, it's a fun conversation. And if you like it, great. Seriously, I wish I liked it more, and I'm glad you do. So have a great time, and we will see you in a couple of weeks. Oh, not see you. You'll hear us in a couple of weeks. And we're going to be looking at Here Come the Coeds on episode number 15 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for all the great response. You know, in society, the last one we did has over 1,500 listens, and that's just YouTube.
Wow.
That's not on all the other platforms. So actually, this is starting to take off, and I'm really, really happy about it. And thank you very, very much. All right. You guys take care of yourselves, and we will see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Give my regards to Pocomoco.
Pocomoco! Slow!